Today on Against the Grain, Jews and the left have been closely associated with each other for well over a century, both in Europe, where the Nazis genocidally linked one with the other, and in the United States. Scholar Benjamin Balthaser considers the history of American Jews and the left, including in opposition to Jewish nationalism, arguing that the recent florescence of Jewish anti-Zionism is a return to a much longer tradition. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Jews have played an outsized role on the U.S. left, yet Zionist nationalism has also frayed those bonds. We're going to spend the hour talking about the history of American Jews within the left, and even against the left, with Benjamin Balthaser, Associate Professor of Multi-Ethnic U.S. Literature at Indiana University South Bend, and the author of Citizens of the Whole World, Anti-Zionism and the Cultures of the American Jewish Left. Benjamin, I wonder if we can start with the present, with the flowering of Jewish anti-Zionism that has only accelerated since Israel's genocide in Gaza. How would you characterize, if you can, the scope of the anti-imperialist and socialist Jewish left today?
So the Jewish left today is in kind of a funny place. So as you mentioned, there's a long association going all the way back to the late 19th century, particularly sort of the immigrant waves of Eastern European Jews and the American left, beginning with the labor movement and really sort of cresting at its peak with the socialist and communist movement into mid-century. The general sensibility of whom were anti-Zionist, right? So, I mean, there were some Zionists on the left in the United States in the 20s, the 30s, but they were relatively rare. And as one Jewish communist author, Robert Gessner, wrote in the New Masses, about 1% of American Jews, and he was really referring to the left, are Zionists. And so in one sense, you could say that, you know, the sort of formation of kind of American Jewish culture as it sort of formed, you know, in the sort of, you know, cauldron of Americanization in the early 20th century, really sort of came out of kind of a socialist sensibility and again, a kind of suspicion, if not downright hostility to Zionism. This gets picked up a little bit in the 1960s with SDS, Students for Democratic Society, and the Socialist Workers Party, both of which had kind of vast representation of American Jews in them, and also were themselves incredibly hostile to Zionism. And so today, on some level, what we're seeing is a continuity, right? So Jewish Voice for Peace is really one of the largest Jewish organizations in the United States. Of course, people will often say that it's a minority position, but it's a large membership organization. It's also one of the larger organizations on the left itself, with, you know, tens of thousands of members. And so in one sense, you could say Jewish Voice for Peace and other groups that are kind of, you know, in the same orbit, like If Not Now or JFRED, Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, are kind of carrying on this tradition of a kind of a diasporic, progressive, kind of anti-imperialist, or at least anti-Zionist sensibility. On the other hand, though, there's been a real rupture, right? So if you want to think about the history of the Jewish left in America, much of it was really infused with a kind of Marxism and socialist sensibility and really kind of embedded in kind of working middle class. And the Jewish left today is, you know, I'm a JVP member, but it is, and very proud of being a JVP member, but it is not really a Marxist organization. You know, it only, I think, relatively recently has kind of adopted a framework of anti-imperialism rather than human rights. And so it is really sort of a kind of left that is coming out of, or a Jewish kind of revulsion against Zionism, that is as much kind of coming out of traditions of American liberalism that it is from the history of the U.S. left. That is one of the ironies, one could say, is that as Zionism really kind of took over or replaced kind of broad Jewish commitment to socialism, the revolt is really coming kind of from within the house, right? So as many American Jews who think of themselves as liberals are rapidly seeing Israel ruled by a fascist government and committing a genocide, want no part of it, right? So, and are kind of, you know, looking for any exit they can possibly find, and joining anti-Zionist organizations, or at least, kind of publicly breaking up with Israel. And so this is, it's a kind of funny moment. And so in one sense, like I said, like anti-Zionism is probably more visible as part of kind of American Jewish liberal to left culture. And at the same time, the American Jewish left, such as it exists, is, I would say, less Marxist or revolutionary than it's been really since its kind of founding in the late 19th century. So it's a kind of a funny moment that we're in, and it's a little paradoxical, but it is also, like I said, probably not all that different from the position of the larger American left right now, right? So, which is both, you could see a kind of continuity, but also a real break from kind of the mid 20th century.
And we'll return as we go to how these currents sort of arrived in the present. And to that end, let me just start in the late 19th and early 20th century, where Jews migrated to the United States in large numbers. Can you remind us of what sort of left-wing traditions they brought with them, and what left cultures did they foster in the United States in that period broadly of the turn of the 20th century?
So there's a kind of, I would say, accurate misperception that sort of Jewish left-wing culture in America was an import from Eastern Europe. Of course, it's widely known that there was a large Jewish presence in European communist and socialist parties. The Jewish Labor Bund was one of the largest and most militant revolutionary organizations, and really sort of was kind of the backbone of the 1905 revolution in the Russian Empire. But as historian Tony Michaels points out, the Jewish left was really kind of an autochthonous formation, and actually preceded the European Jewish left by a couple of decades. So in one sense, you could say there's a long history of associating Jews with kind of forces of, you could say, secular democracy. So of course, as we all know, the French Revolution recognized the rights of Jews for the first time in a European state. And this kind of wedded, you could say, European Jewish intelligentsia to kind of ideas of the Enlightenment and sort of progressive forces of democracy. But the idea of a revolutionary left was really kind of a formation of the late 19th and early 20th century. And in the United States, it really sort of came out of the kind of formation of the American labor movement in the 1880s and 1890s, in which Jewish working class and sort of peasant immigrants were encountering radical German immigrants. So if actually anybody brought, you could say, socialism with them as a foreign import, it was actually radical Germans who had fled the 1848 revolutions in Europe. And of course, a lot of different immigrant groups in the late 19th and early 20th centuries were joining the labor movement and joining socialist parties. The socialist party was incredibly large in the late 19th and early 20th century, led by Eugene Debs. And of course, there are a number of other smaller left-wing organizations that were in its orbit. And Jews were a large part of this, but along with a lot of other, you said, working class immigrants. So, German American socialists, Finnish American socialists, Mexican American socialist organizers. Of course, you have the Mexican Revolution, which had enormous kind of cross-border circuits of intellectual and political formation. And so Jews were sort of, like I said, a part of that. And I think the interesting thing is that for American Jews, it kind of hung on, longer and with a kind of a deeper presence than with other, particularly European immigrants. So the sort of German American socialist movement kind of dies out by the early 20th century. And with Jews, it really, American Jews, it really hung around for much longer. And so, you get these amazing statistics that the Communist Party in the 1930s and 1940s was half Jewish. And of course, SDS at its foundation was also half Jewish. So a lot of historians have used phrases such as Karen Brodkin of hegemonic Jewish American socialism, right? Not to say that every Jew who came to the United States or was alive in the early 20th century was a socialist, but rather that sort of anti-capitalist attitudes and a kind of social democratic ethos was, you could say, common sense for most working class American Jews. And in one sense, like I said, it was a part of the kind of wider formations of kind of working class adherence to the kind of left-wing labor movement and the Socialist Party. But I think for American Jews, there was another sense as well in which their memory of being a racialized minority in Europe and the presence in the United States, particularly in the 1920s with anti-immigration laws and the kind of eugenics movement, there was a kind of sense in which to thrive in America, one had to make it into a multi-ethnic and multi-racial democracy. And I think there was a extra sense in which for American Jews, they saw the fate of African Americans and related it back to their experience in the Pale of Settlement in Russia, right? So there's a really wonderful book by Amelia Glazer about Yiddish language literature and poetry. And she says over and over and over again, kind of Yiddish writers and newly arrived immigrants would see the fate of African Americans in Jim Crow, see lynchings, and immediately relate it back to and understand it through the lens of their experiences in Eastern Europe. Of course, this is the heyday of Russian pogroms, which would sometimes kill tens of thousands of people a year. And so I think there was a sense that not only did American Jews kind of join the labor movement as many other recent immigrants did, but there was a sense too in which becoming part of a kind of anti-racial, anti-racist, multi-ethnic sensibility fit with their own sense of how to survive as a religious and ethnic minority in a country that was very openly racist and eugenic, right, an anti-immigrant. So that is, I think, like I said, the kind of, you say, the beginning point or emergence of this kind of widespread American Jewish left in the first part of the 20th century.
Right, and that thread of a sense of solidarity with the Black freedom struggle, with civil rights for Jews on the left is, you know, a thread that goes throughout American history. And then, of course, Frey's in various ways with support for the State of Israel. But before we get to that, you were just talking about why was it that Jews stayed on the left when, you know, in the early 20th century, there were obviously these ways that left-wing immigrants would organize themselves along lines of nationality, especially in the Communist Party, the Hungarian clubs, and the Germans, as you say, had these radical traditions, but then they were integrated within the larger politics of the United States and didn't necessarily have that radical edge. When you think about the disproportionate membership of Jews in the Communist Party in the 1930s, when the Communist Party was doing a lot of organizing in the South, do you think that the Black freedom struggle and that sense of solidarity was important for explaining the sort of high level of participation and identification with communism and socialism more broadly amongst Jews?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I would say it's absolutely central. And I like the way that you frame that, that on some level, as much as many kind of immigrant members of the working class came to the United States and joined, you know, various radical labor movements and eventually kind of assimilated into a kind of normative, you could say, for at least European immigrants, a sense of whiteness and kind of representation in mainstream political parties, really what's kind of formulated, I think, the kind of beating heart of the American Jewish left, particularly at mid-century, was a sense of solidarity with African Americans. And it's just something you see everywhere, right? Since the book is about the American Jewish left, but also the way in which kind of anti-Zionist imaginaries helped to formulate kind of a leftist sensibility, that was also a huge part of the criticism of Zionism, right? So even before the foundation of the State of Israel, people referred to the new Yishuv, the sort of, you know, colonist settlements in Mandate Palestine, as a Jim Crow state, right? And so their reference to it was not something particular to the Middle East, but they saw the kind of segregation of the settlements between the Jews and Palestinians and immediately recognized it as, you know, their primary enemy in the United States, the Jim Crow system, right? And of course, if you, you know, look at the Communist Party in the 1930s, you know, obviously, being part of the labor movement was always central to both socialism and communism, and also, of course, the anarchist movement as well. But what really made the American Communist Party, I think, kind of different from the Socialist Party was that anti-racism was not a simply add-on or something that was kind of tacked on. It was really central to both the sensibility of American communism and I think also to the success, the brief success of American communism in the United States. So, you know, everything from kind of recognizing kind of nascent Black nationalism to recognizing the Black freedom struggle to putting, you know, ending Jim Crow really at kind of the forefront of how American communists understood their struggle really appealed to a lot of American Jews. And I think one also, just to make a brief aside, this is really different than the European left, right? So Enzo Traverso has a really wonderful book, Marxism and the Jewish Question. And he writes about, you know, how it was really difficult for Jews on the left to have anti-Semitism and broader racism be recognized by Marxist parties. In fact, actually a lot of Marxist and socialist parties in the late 19th century and early 20th century were very hostile to the idea that addressing racism, anti-Semitism should have a special place in socialist politics. They were really sort of class first Marxists. And, you know, of course, this was a big debate, you know, in the Communist Party of Europe as well. And of course, a big debate even within the Soviet Union, particularly in the 1920s, before the rise of Stalin. And so I think if you want to go back to the United States, one of the reasons why kind of American communism appealed to so many Jewish Americans was that it really put anti-racism at the center and also allowed for a unique expression of Jewish culture, right? So, you know, one of the most popular Jewish left-wing publications of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s was Morgen Freiheit. It was written in Yiddish, right? So Morning Freedom, which was a Communist Party publication. And so as much as the Communist Party could say, you know, is marked by a kind of universalism, perhaps a tragic universalism, given its adherence to the Soviet line, it really also kind of fostered, again, a kind of soft cultural nationalism for, as you mentioned, all these different language clubs, obviously the Black freedom struggle, and particularly for American Jews as well, who, like I said, had an active and thriving Yiddish press within it.
I'm speaking with scholar of American Studies Benjamin Balthaser, author of Citizens of the Whole World, Anti-Zionism and the Cultures of the American Jewish Left. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, of course, in mid-century, there was the unspeakable devastation of the Holocaust. There was the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, mass expulsion of the Palestinians. And in the post-war period, American Jewish life changed in a number of ways, some economic in terms of increased social mobility, and of course, McCarthyism and the Red Scare against communists and other radicals. How do you make sense of how these, and I realize it's a very tall order putting them all together in one question, shaped how the American Jewish left understood itself?
Yeah, well, in some ways, actually, they kind of all have to be understood together. And as you mentioned, you know, the late 1940s, early 1950s was just a groundbreaking, earth-shattering change in American Jewish life in all kinds of ways, right? So you have, on the one sense, the phenomenon of white flight, and also urban renewal. And so a number of dense multi-ethnic neighborhoods within big cities are being both decimated by the construction of the new highway system. So for instance, I'm in Chicago, and one of the largest sort of working class Jewish neighborhoods in the middle of Chicago, Maxwell Street, was bulldozed to create UIC, University of Illinois in Chicago. And of course, like I said, a lot, the Bronx, as Marshall Berman has frequently written about, was, leveled and destroyed. And this, of course, the Bronx was, again, this kind of vibrant working class, multi-ethnic neighborhood. You could say really one of kind of the centers of kind of Jewish left politics. And of course, at the same time, you have the decimation of these kind of working class and multi-ethnic neighborhoods and big cities. You also have white flight and sort of Jews being allowed into the sort of all white suburbs for the first time. And of course, you also have the lifting of quotas against Jews in Ivy League universities. And so, this phenomenon, and of course, the expansion of the middle class in general, right? The expansion of the civil service, state apparatuses like, the public university, public school systems, federal bureaucracy, and Jews are entering into these ranks in massive numbers, right? And so you have the lifting of, what was, a second, third generation kind of working class communities into the American middle class in huge numbers. As Grace Paley put it, Jews rose like a surface-to-air missile into the middle class. And of course, the second part of Grace Paley's metaphor, which I really love, is, you could say, the military state, right? And so at the same time, you have the sort of assimilation of Jews into sort of normative patterns of whiteness, you also have the expansion of the Cold War military state, and particularly the Red Scare. And so it was a kind of, you could say, carrot and stick phenomenon in which, the Red Scare really decimated. So this vibrant Jewish left that I've been talking about was completely decimated by the Red Scare. So the largest socialist Jewish organization, the Jewish People's Fraternal Order, which was affiliated with the Communist Party, was literally banned, right? So this had, tens of thousands of members, again, had an active press, summer camps, one of which actually still exists, Camp Kinderland, which is one of the sort of last vestiges of this kind of older Jewish left, but, had an entire kind of cultural apparatus, Yiddish shuls, and was kind of the hub of an entire kind of Jewish left-wing world. Of course, you also have the decimation of the left wing of the labor movement. The dozen or so unions that are affiliated with the Communist Party are essentially destroyed. And then, of course, you have the virtual banning of the Communist Party itself, the driving of communists and other left-wingers out of the university system, out of the federal bureaucracy. And also the destruction of multiracial civil rights organizations like the Civil Rights Congress, right? And so, at the same time you have the emergence of the civil rights movement, you also have the destruction of the Black left, which also, the leadership of which was very much integrated with the kind of, Communist Party and the Jewish left. So the Civil Rights Congress, probably most famously remembered for the We Charge Genocide petition in the 1950s to the UN, its leadership, was half Jewish and half African American, and many of its chapters were also split between Jews and African Americans. And so, again, this kind of broad, you could say, working class, urban Jewish left that saw itself as aligned with the kind of Black and internationalist left was just, the devastation of it is really hard to overemphasize. And one of the things that I found when I was doing interviews for the second and third chapters of the book, which were on the new left, is that, even people for whom this is not their own family history, they were not so-called red diaper babies, this was the message that a lot of American Jews received. Everybody sort of knew somebody who was a communist and who lost their job. Everyone saw the Rosenbergs be executed. And as my own mother put it, was an example of the Jews on the left that, the state will come after you and possibly even execute you. And so the fear and sense of persecution was quite palpable. And so the last part of your question was about Zionism. And this is also a very large tragedy, although it doesn't really actually become as important as one might think it is until the late 1960s and early 70s. But of course, the Communist Party, the Soviet Union, backs the formation of the State of Israel in late 1947. So, you know, Andrei Gromyko comes out very dramatically to the UN and basically says, you know, you did nothing to, you know, says to the world, you did nothing to stop the Holocaust and watched it happen. And now we can make amends by forming the State of Israel. And from the point of view of the Soviet Union, this was sheer geopolitics. I mean, you know, Stalin was a notorious anti-Semite and, you know, cared nothing for the liberation really of anybody, except maybe, you know, his own state apparatus. But, you know, understood, I think, quite clearly that the United States was going to be vying for imperial control of the Middle East and for the resources that the Middle East represented, and thought perhaps that he could pull the Yishuv and the State of Israel into the Soviet camp, which was not entirely implausible. There was a not small Communist Party in Israel. But this, of course, you know, didn't last very long. It lasted until kind of the early 1950s. But it meant that at the moment of Israel's formation, what might have been a much larger protest on the left was really muted. I should say, though, the left press, the left Jewish press was kind of funny on it. So, you know, it took the kind of, you know, Soviet Party line. Of course, one has to remember the Soviet Union had an enormous amount of prestige in the late 1940s. You know, this might sound rather strange to say, but before the Red Scare, you know, the Soviet Union was the country that had defeated Hitler, right? And it was not seen as necessarily treasonous to be a member of the Communist Party, maybe radical, maybe, you know, subversive, but it was not seen as treasonous or traitorous, right? Until the really the kind of beginning of the Red Scare. And so for the Soviet Union to support the State of Israel carried a lot of weight. And for a lot of leftists and even liberals, this really changed the dialogue and the discourse around it. But there was still, I think, a lot of kind of quiet Jewish left-wing dissent. You know, one of the authors that I spend a lot of time with, Mike Gold, who was, you could say, kind of the most famous and pugnacious Jewish communist editor and novelist, music promoter, busybody of the 1930s and 1940s, you know, kept his mouth very shut about the formation of the State of Israel. And I uncovered this entire play, which is incredibly critical, that he never published. And this seemed to be the attitude of a lot of Jewish leftists, that, you know, they were not happy about the formation of the State of Israel, but, you know, decided to keep their mouth shut to be good communists. And I think also, too, you know, this is the beginning of the Red Scare in the United States, and they had other things on their mind. But, you know, this, at least in terms of the kind of Jewish elite, and kind of the expected, perhaps, protest that one might have thought would have happened on the Jewish left, this started the beginning of the kind of wedding of American Jewish liberals and even some leftists with the sort of nationalist project in Palestine. So.
Right. And you remind us in your book that, you know, although there is a sort of ahistorical sense that Jews in the United States have been fervently Zionist from the get-go, that actually the embrace of Zionism, including by liberal institutions, really happened later and in a particular context. I wonder if you could talk about that, how Zionism became this sort of hegemonic force among American Jews and American Jewish liberals especially, and also how Israel then took on a notion, at least for some Jews, of, you know, representing a kind of quasi-socialist experiment with various American Jews going to Israeli kibbutzes, these communal settlements, of course, on dispossessed Palestinian land, and this notion that Israel actually represented something radical. How did those all sort of cohere?
Yeah, well, I'll take the last part of that first. The other question about how Zionism became a kind of manufactured hegemony, not only in the American Jewish community, but also, you could say, even in all of America. I'll get to you in a second. But on the question of the kind of popular imaginary of Israel as a socialist state, And I would say with some, you know, amount of confession, I didn't grow up in a particularly Zionist household. My grandparents were communists and anti-Zionists. My mom, you know, aunts and uncles, etc., were probably not as ideologically committed to anti-Zionism as my grandparents were. But, you know, they didn't have any particular great adherence to it. But I remember, I think, reading maybe in, you know, some newspaper about the kibbutzes, you know, when I was a high school student, and just thought, not knowing much about Israel, you know, just thought, oh, how wonderful, there's a country full of Jewish socialists, you know, in the Mediterranean, must be a great place. And, you know, it took me a while to become, again, kind of disabused of this notion. But yeah, so that was part of Israel's kind of propaganda for a long time. And one of the people that I interviewed for the book, Jill Benin, was actually a member of Hashomer Hatzer, which was a socialist Zionist organization that had a kind of youth movement in the United States, and was kind of an offshoot, one of the many breakaways of the Communist Party, particularly when the Communist Party became anti-Zionist in the 1930s and again in the 1950s. And he, you know, went to Israel, as many Jewish socialists did in the 1960s, expecting to find this kind of, you know, paradise of Jewish socialism. You know, everything he was taught to believe was true about, you know, Jewish history. And, you know, the first thing that he found unsettling was that when he was on the kibbutz, he heard a lot of, you know, derogatory racial slurs against Palestinians. And then, you know, the next day, you know, after hearing this, you know, very shortly afterwards, he's watching, of all things, Hair, dubbed into Hebrew, on television, and which is just a surreal thought, you know, out in a kibbutz in northern Israel. There's a scene in Hair where, you know, a U.S. flag is destroyed, and, you know, he and all of his sort of American hippie friends are finding this delightful. And he says, you know, the Israeli kibbutzniks are like not laughing at all. And he said, you know, it hit him at this moment, you know, the racial slurs and also the sententiousness around an American flag that, oh, right, these people are nationalists, right? They're not really socialists, they're really nationalists. And this is, I think, what, you know, historians in kind of retrospect have come to articulate. You know, Lev Sternhall has written about this, that as much as, you know, the kind of foundations of the Jewish state, you know, Ben-Gurion, et cetera, you know, was sort of officially Labor Party, Mapai, and had a kind of social democratic rhetoric. This was always secondary, you know, the Histadrut, you know, the sort of Jewish Labor Federation in Israel, was really foundational to the state. The nationalism always came first, and it was always an apartheid regime. So, you know, they would say that we're not exploiting Palestinian labor, but what that really meant was that these were segregated settlements, right? And this is really the failure of the Israeli Communist Party, you know, at its foundation, to really become a force to possibly transform, you know, the kind of beginnings of Israel into something more democratic, egalitarian, and less racist, was that, you know, the Israeli Communist Party basically split in almost immediately into two groups. There was the Jewish Israeli one and the one that still exists, which is Hadash, essentially the Palestinian Israeli Communist Party. And so, like I said, you know, the putative socialism of the Zionist project, I think people were sincere about it. You know, like I said, you know, Joel Benin was sincere about it when he went. It's just that the project of Israel, you know, is forming a Jewish majority and Jewish supremacist state. And that was always going to be secondary to any kind of socialist project, right? And you can't have a socialist project that is simultaneously displacing people from their land and engaging in acts of apartheid, right? You know, socialism, if it is anything, is supposed to be a universalist project. I'm in the same way too, you know, in the United States, you know, as Marx famously said, there's going to be no labor movement until slavery is ended, right? You know, and that until, you know, labor and black skin ceases to be branded, labor and white skin will never be free. And so I think the same thing was true in Israel, that, like I said, the socialist project was always at the service of its formation as a racist and nationalist project. But you know, this myth, you know, held, I think, really until the 1980s, right, and the sort of election of Menachem Begin in the 1970s. And then even after that, for a while, you know, through the Oslo peace process, the idea that, you know, Israel is a kind of social democratic, progressive state, you know, people really thought of it as, you know, the sixth borough of New York City in some ways, you know, this kind of, again, multi-ethnic progressive place. And this is, again, part of an aggressive kind of Hasbara, you know, apparatus that up until recently, a good part of not only the American Jewish community, but the American, you know, sort of liberals writ large had bought, you know, the only democracy in the Middle East, you know, respects gay rights. Of course, you know, Israel is very fond of presenting itself as a multi-ethnic and multiracial society, which in some, you know, very narrow and instrumentalist sense is. But of course, you know, this hides not only the displacement of Palestinians, but the discrimination both of Israeli citizens of Israel, but even Jews of color within Israel. So, you know, the Sephardic and particularly Mizrahi and North African Jews have always been discriminated against within Israeli society. But this gets back to your other question about how this, you know, essentially apartheid state became hegemonic both within an American Jewish community defined first by its leftism and then its liberalism, and you could say America writ large. So one of the other sort of myths is that, you know, as soon as Israel is established, the entire American, liberal American Jewish establishment immediately became super Zionist, right, ultra Zionist. This is sort of true in the sense that large kind of liberal Jewish organizations like the American Jewish Committee and the ADL were nominally Zionist, but you also had very large liberal Jewish organizations like the American Council on Judaism that was actually still committedly anti-Zionist, right? This was the large kind of reform organization led by Elmer Berger. And that, you know, one of the most popular Jewish publications throughout the 1950s was the Jewish Newsletter, edited by William Zuckerman, who himself was a very known critic of Zionism. He referred to Israel as quote unquote machine gun Judaism, right? And so, you know, recognized that even by the 1930s as a form of ethno-fascism and saw a lot of the racial and anti-Palestinian policies in the 1950s and equated them with McCarthyism, right? So even in the 1950s, there was a great deal of dissent in among American liberal Jews with the project of Israel. So the American Jewish Committee and the ADL, I think you could say, tried to have it both ways. So in the one sense, yes, they wanted to sort of, you know, be in good graces of prominent Israeli politicians, but also were very willing, at least throughout the 1950s, to openly criticize Israel. So, you know, criticize the expulsion of Palestinians. So in the 1950s, this is referred to as the, you know, Palestinian refugee crisis. And, you know, had actually many researchers writing reports on the crisis of Palestinian refugees in the 1950s as being the thing that will undermine eventually and destroy Israel, right? And then, of course, there's a lot of criticism about, you know, the Israeli national citizenship law, which denied citizenship rights to the Palestinian refugees as well. And again, so even though, like I said, the ADL and AJC, which were nominally liberal organizations, you know, supported civil rights, supported you know, King Southern Christian Leadership Conference. It wasn't really until the 1960s that these organizations became explicitly Zionist. And you can actually look, you know, there's a really wonderful dissertation by Matt Berkman, who's presented actually his findings actually for the AJC, and in which he points at the way in which you can actually look at the, you can actually like follow the money. So if you look at like what the AJC was spending its money on, in 1966, it would look like, you know, anti-poverty programs for, you know, working class Jews. It would look like Holocaust resettlement, Jewish education, civil rights, you know, civil rights struggles, democratic, you know, things along those lines, you know, sort of things that you would expect out of a sort of nominally socially democratic organization aligned with the Democratic Party, or the Anti-Defamation League. If you look at the Anti-Defamation League, you know, what were they publishing research on? It was the American far right. It was the John Birchers, right? And then suddenly in 1967, this all changes. You know, what Norm Poteritz refers to as the mass conversion of American Jews to Zionism. And there's a lot of ways to understand this. I think, and this might be, there's a debate within, you know, kind of Jewish studies scholarship about how to understand it. And I would take the position that on some level, large liberal Jewish organizations have always on some level followed the lead of the American state. So they, you know, the primary objective of the AJC and ADL and the, you know, American Council on Judaism, although, you know, it doesn't really exist any longer in the shape that it once did, was always sort of to prove that they're good, patriotic, democratic Americans, right? And so when, you know, in the 1950s, the American state was nominally pro-Israel, although certainly willing to entertain critiques of Israel and, you know, cautiously lend support to various Arab nationalist organizations. The American state really, this is, you know, I'm citing work by Melanie McAllister, sort of, you know, American studies scholars like Melanie McAllister and Amy Kaplan. The American state, you know, particularly the American empire, saw the Israeli victory over the Arab nationalist forces of, you know, Nasser, the Ba'athists in Syria, you know, and these kind of lightning strikes as the United States was, you know, bogged down in Vietnam. And basically saw Israel as a better version of America, right? You know, here is the country that is doing all the things that America still wants to do in the world. You know, defeat its adversaries, seemingly, you know, act in its own self-defense, you know, and it's doing it, right? And so, you know, America, the United States, sort of Pentagon, American state apparatus, Time Magazine, the New York Times, really just sort of fell in love with Israel overnight. And you know, this there was a, you say, an enormous kind of propaganda campaign to see Israel essentially as the new American Superman. And this sort of led a lot of the Jewish organizations that really wanted to be Zionist, but to embrace it wholeheartedly. And at this point, you could see American Jewish organizations shift from, you know, a kind of what was referred to at the time as non-Zionism to embracing Zionism as the sole purpose of their organization. And so the money sort of immediately moves to combating basically the American left and even the American Jewish left, and putting all of their efforts towards supporting Israel, supporting trips to Israel, supporting Israeli state propaganda, and trying to influence American state policy. And this is really the kind of the beginning of what is referred to as the American Jewish consensus on Zionism, which sort of lasts from the late 1960s up into, you know, possibly the early 2000s.
I'm speaking with Benjamin Baltazar, author of Citizens of the Whole World, Anti-Zionism and the Cultures of the American Left. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So, compressing a fair amount of history, I wonder if you could talk about over that period, you know, where Zionism was embraced by the liberal establishment in the United States, the liberal Jewish establishment. You note that establishment Jewish organizations shifted from seeing, say, the far right, Christian, white supremacists as the source of anti-Semitism to instead focusing on left anti-Zionism. And I wonder if you could talk about how, over that period, the left fractured and frayed over some of these questions. You had noted that the new left, you know, half of the new left was Jewish. With the ascendancy of Zionism, the kind of historic alliance between the Black freedom struggle and Jewish leftists started to really fray as the Black Power movement took an anti-colonial, anti-imperialist position on these questions. Something similar also happened within the feminist movement, splits over Zionism. How would you characterize how that affected the left, if we could call it the Jewish left, rather than Jewish liberals, in the period from the late 60s through the early 2000s? And what form did these tensions take?
Yeah, well, as you know, one thing I would just say is that we're in some level in a much better position than we were in the early 70s. I think, you know, anti-Zionism, at least the criticism of Zionism, has become again a kind of left consensus. So, you know, organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, magazines like Jewish Currents, have really, I think you could say, returned us back to first principles and allowed for multi-ethnic coalitions, critical of Zionism, like the Mamdani campaign in New York City, to take center stage again, right? And so, and I think this has been, you could say, at least in part, the work of the kind of Jewish left to really kind of make anti-Zionism, or to help make anti-Zionism, you could say, kosher again, for the broad left. And of course, you have the Democratic Socialists of America in 2017 passing a BDS resolution, and the DSA was the last, you could say, Zionist socialist organization in the United States. And so it has also made this big shift. And so, like I said, we're sort of at the end of this interregnum period between the 1970s and the present, in which Zionism was a debate on the left, right? So yes, Zionism is still a debate in the United States, particularly among liberals and the Democratic Party. But on the left, I think the question has been settled. Of course, there are other questions about what anti-Zionism actually means, about the nature of the struggle, about tactics, and et cetera. But there is no large organization on the American left, from DSA to JVP, that I think sees Zionism as a representation of its own ambition in the world. But in the 1960s and 1970s, yes, there was a huge split on the left, and also really among liberals. I would say actually the split in some way, on some level, that happened in the 1960s and early 1970s, you could say broke off kind of the social democratic left from the anti-imperialist left, right? And this split happened in SDS, it happened, you know, kind of across the left in general. So in 1967, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, comes out with basically a broadside against Zionism, right? And essentially accuses Zionism after the Six-Day War of aligning with American imperialism and the forces of racism. And at this point, this really forces a question. So Zionism, you know, there were many critics of Zionism before 1967 that were on the left, you know, even Jewish critics, you know, Irwin Silber of The Guardian, Noam Chomsky, etc. But when SNCC comes out in 1967 with this broadside against Israel and Zionism and sides with Arab nationalism, this really forces the question. So, you know, if SDS was anything, it was, as many of its members referred to it, the northern arm of SNCC, right? It really saw itself as an organization primarily against the Vietnam War and allied with the Black freedom struggle, right? And so if the Black freedom struggle is coming out in favor of Palestine, this really forced the question. And so for most of, I would say, the anti-imperialist left, and even the anti-imperialist Jewish left, you know, figures like Bernadine Dorn, Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Mark Rudd, Susan Klonsky, et cetera, and these are sort of the, you know, leaders of both the Yippies and SDS, they remained anti-Zionist and supported Black power. But for a lot of kind of Jewish social democrats, this was an absolute crisis. There's a kind of famous, or maybe infamous, conference that was held in 1970 at the Arden House that sort of brought kind of all of the luminaries of kind of the Jewish kind of liberal left, social democratic establishment, you know, Seymour Lipschitz, Irving Howe, et cetera, to sort of talk about this crisis. You know, what are we going to do now that the left, you know, the radical left, the anti-imperialist left, has turned against Zionism? And this was explicitly felt in the feminist movement. I mean, it's really hard to imagine now that radical feminists like, you know, Shmuel Firestone, Susan Brown Miller, et cetera, would have thought of themselves as Zionists in the 1970s, because, you know, it's a state project based on violence. And if we think of Zionism as anything, right, it's often against sort of the phallic power of states and their capacity to commit acts of violence. And yet there was a big identification, or a strong identification, particularly in the kind of feminist movement, which was had, again, like the left, a very outsized Jewish presence. And this really led to profound fractures that really sort of split apart this grand coalition, you could say, between a kind of Jewish social democratic ethos that had sort of lived on through the 1960s and 1970s, and the Black left, right? And this is also a moment in which the left itself is fracturing, you know, after the heyday of the 1960s, with a kind of, you know, white backlash of the 1970s. And so Zionism becomes, on some level, not the only force that is breaking up the left, but certainly one of the ways in which it is named, right? And I think you can see this even today, that Zionism is not the only force, you know, that undermined, you know, Joe Biden's Democratic Party, but is sort of the name under which, or the sign under which, the split between the left and, you say, liberals really happened. And the same thing happened again in the 1970s and late 1960s. And so, you know, this, and of course, the split, you know, was due to many things, right? So, you know, obviously a lot of the organizations that fostered a, you know, so-called Black Jewish Alliance, you know, had also, were also in the process of breaking up, you know, so, you know, Jews had long ago sort of, you say, moved to the suburbs, and had sort of, you know, left in class terms, from their African-American allies. And Zionism was another way to sort of think about the breaking up of this partnership. I think one of the lessons that one can learn from, I would say, the kind of dissolution and breakup of the leftover Zionism in the 1960s and 1970s, and actually would say the reformation of a kind of American left now, is that, you know, American empire is always domestic policy, right? There's not going to be a left that can kind of ignore or cast aside the U.S. imperial commitments, right? And so, you know, Israel is not just an American Jewish problem, it certainly is that, but it is also an American problem, right? America is responsible right now for genocide and for the unwavering support for the state of Israel. And this is going to keep refracting back on the American left and American liberalism. And until, you know, like I said, in the same way the Vietnam War, you could say, did the same, until American liberalism can live up to, you know, its stated ideals of human freedom, the commitment to American imperialism for the Jewish left and, like I said, the American left is always going to come back and pose a question, right, of its universalism and its commitment to human rights. And so, like I said, until the Palestine question is answered in the United States, the left is not going to be able to come back into any kind of meaningful coalition or power.
Benjamin Balthaser, thank you.
Thank you. This is delightful.
I've been speaking with the author of Citizens of the Whole World, Anti-Zionism and the Cultures of the American Jewish Left. He's associate professor of multi-ethnic U.S. literature at Indiana University South Bend, and his other books include Anti-Imperialist Modernism. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.